Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today, I'm going to be looking at Britain's status in the world after 1945, and the ideas that the post-war Labour government had about conscription and national service, the continuation of wartime service, and the sense that the British were looking out on a changing landscape for Britain, a changing international landscape for Britain, and a sense of world disorder. This obviously predates the loss of India by 2 years, and at the end of the Second World War, it takes really until late 1946 for the penny to drop for Britain that really India will not be retained as part of the empire, and the attempt to put on trial members of the Indian National Army who had fought for Subhas Chandra Bose and fought against the empire and fought on the side of Japan during the war was such an enormous faux pas by the British. I mean, faux pas doesn't really kind of do it justice. Enormous political blunder by the British, that whatever remaining goodwill there was as amongst some parts of the Indian population quickly evaporated, and the British realised that there was very little chance of actually assembling a jury that would be remotely likely to convict any members of the INA. The way in which the Labour government of 1945 dealt with the international picture that emerged after the war is one of kind of, in some ways, contradictions, some ways levels of confusion. Labour had been a part of the wartime cabinet, Churchill's wartime cabinet, and the Labour Party was while she signed up to most of the policy positions of the Conservatives, a close relationship with America, which really sort of maintained itself up until the present day, the pursuing of a nuclear weapon. It was Ernest Bevin, Labour's foreign secretary, who said, you know, we need a bomb with the Union flag on it. Labour also believed that big defence commitments must be maintained. Perhaps there was no way that a period of national service that lasted as long as 6 years, as wartime had demanded, perhaps there was no way that that was sustainable. But Britain still had, even after the loss of India, still has huge overseas commitments. It has commitments that it doesn't fully recognise, appreciate or understand emerging as a result of the new dynamics of the Cold War. And it has a belief that the territorial integrity of the United Kingdom must be vigorously defended. A year or two after the end of the Second World War, we're in a still very uncertain international environment. It's very unlikely that anybody is going to suggest that decommissioning bases on British soil is a good idea. So we're going to look at Richard Vinen's book on national service today, National Service, Conscription in Britain, 1945-63. It's very, it's not simply about the politics of conscription. It's really a kind of a history of Britain as a transitioning power, I think is the way to put it. The narrative of kind of British imperial decline, British international decline, always needs to have the word relative in there. Britain throughout the second half of the 20th century still remains a fairly significant military power and a significant world economy. It's simply in relative to the United States and catch-up countries like West Germany and Japan in the 1960s and 70s, it experienced relative decline. So, Richard Vinen writes, at the end of the war, there was a period of uncertainty about Britain's future military burdens. A report by the Armistice and Post-War Committee to the War Cabinet summed matters up in April 1945. Okay, so this is a month before the war had ended. It would clearly have been desirable for the starting point of our examination to have been a comprehensive review of the post-war defence problem of the British Empire, from which could be deduced the size of the forces to be maintained in the United Kingdom, both for fulfilment and of its obligations under the World Organization. By this, we're talking about the United Nations and affiliated institutions, and for essential security tasks in different parts of the world. It is clear to us, however, that no such review is possible at the present time. In October 1945, writes Richard Vinen, Ian Jacob, military assistant to the Secretary of the War Cabinet, explained why the government would find it difficult to make an immediate decision about future conscription, but added, new scientific developments, in particular the atomic bomb, have caused a feeling of uncertainty about the shape of our future armed forces. It is evident that for some considerable time, the armed forces to be retained will be such that they can only be supported by the continuance of national service on the present basis. The problem will be how to reduce this period spent in the forces by young men called up for something like 6 years to a reasonable period, say 2 years. Jacob anticipated three phases, the first lasting 18 months or 2 years, with bringing forces down to a level that could be sustained by a two-year conscription. Then would come a second period of 3 to 4 years, during which the forces would be maintained at the same level to meet occupational duties on a large scale and other abnormal commitments. A third period would begin after about 5 years, when the abnormal commitments have been discharged, but when the atom bomb and other developments may be expected to begin to affect the layoff of our forces. So there was clearly some sense that the new era of the new atomic age and the development of, I suppose, things like jet technology was going to have an effect in reducing the size of conventional forces eventually. Richard Vinen writes, This uncertainty persisted for some time. A Ministry of Defence report in 1946 said that in the unsettled condition of the world, it was not possible to be sure what forces Britain would need, but that it had certain inescapable commitments. I mean, an example of those would be Britain's deployment in Greece to fight the civil war on behalf of the royalists against the communists, Britain's deployment in Palestine before Britain essentially sort of shirks itself of its responsibilities and tries to dump the issue of Palestine on the United Nations. I mean, and Britain's obviously large deployment in Germany. These were the provision of garrisons in bases overseas, the preservation of law and order in overseas territory, the maintenance of a strategic reserve at home and overseas, the protection of lines of communication, the maintenance of air and coastal defences, the provision of training and administration in the UK for forces throughout the world. The report added that another aim of British policy should be showing the flag. Conscription often fitted into a more general debate about Britain's place in the world that did not necessarily depend on any rational calculation about how it might contribute to military power. The Foreign Office saw willingness to call up young men as a sign of national resolve that would show how Britain had broken with its policy in the 1930s. When our failure to maintain compulsory military service after the 1914-18 war gave the impression that the British people had lost the will and the self-discipline to protect themselves and enforce their voice in world affairs. Now that to me is the interesting bit. Of course we know that Britain had this overlapping series of obligations, from the aftermath of the war, the occupation of, as I said, places like Germany and other parts of Europe, the occupation of parts of Southeast Asia, the intervention in places like Vietnam, and the new frontiers of the Cold War that are gradually emerging, and in addition to that, sort of the garrisoning of the empire and the policing of kind of gradually emerging wars of national liberation. There's a heck of a lot there. But the British also are haunted by what they see as the mistakes of the interwar period, by the defence cuts of the 1930s during the Great Depression. I don't know, I have not seen any evidence that Germany particularly was observing British troop levels and naval spending and all that kind of stuff. I mean, no doubt they have a vast intelligence operation, and no doubt they were. How much that shaped Hitler's decision making is questionable. I've never seen any evidence that it particularly did. The failure to prevent Japan sweeping through Malaya, Singapore, and Burma is almost exclusively down to weakness of troop numbers, out-of-date equipment, the kind of the dregs of British service, really, British colonial service and military service, who were stationed out in Malaya and India and Burma, who through incompetence led to an entirely preventable defeat in Southeast Asia, in the kind of the crescent of Southeast Asia, occur. These are the sorts of things where, after the war, one might rationally think that that Britain advertised and signalled its weakness to the rest of the world. The extent to which the Japanese genuinely believed in British weakness in Malaya, well, again, is unclear. Certainly, all the evidence points to the fact that General Yamashita gambled on the fact that the British wouldn't be able to defend Malaya.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more.
One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And in a sort of, he had observed Blitzkrieg in France in 1940 as a kind of a German guest, and he gambled on the possibility that Blitzkrieg, a rapid offensive to overwhelm the enemy, might be possible in Malaya. And he was right. So the British were very much haunted by this, and the idea that Britain must be seen to have a big world presence. I mean, by the time you get to the mid-1960s, the likes of Harold Wilson continued with this policy and thought that, you know, Britain should have bases east of Suez and be largely for prestigious reasons. Wilson was quite the nationalist figure and believed in kind of nation and empire and monarchy and all that kind of stuff. This sort of idea that various sort of intelligence officers and retired army generals had in the late 1960s, that Wilson was some kind of Bolshevik threat, is very, very much misguided. But by 1967, when Wilson is forced to devalue the pound in abject humiliation, the combination of high welfare spending in Britain and also a commitment to overseas bases becomes too much for the British economy. The big question was Richard Vian, which was to some extent masked by talk of policing occupied territories and maintaining prestige, was what power might pose a real threat to British interests after the defeat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan? The Soviet Union was obviously the most dangerous military antagonist for Britain, but anticipating the particular kind of threat that it would pose and the resources that Britain would have to respond to it was hard, and certainty about the matter haunted British defence policy during the first few years after the Second World War. The result was that the result of this was that post-war conscription was built on the shifting sands of changing strategic assumptions. This is something I think that afflicts probably most nations. Changing strategic assumptions or strategic assumptions change all the time because they have to, because we're in a changing world and countries perceive changing threats. And the kinds of armies that one has to create are always sort of projections into the future. Right now, in any given country you like, there will be military planners thinking, well, what kind of war will we have to wage in 5 or 10 years' time, potentially? What kind of emergencies will our armed services have to respond to? And it was particularly confusing in 1945, here at this kind of great kind of intersection in 20th century history. And a combination of new technologies, new conflicts, dissolving empires, or the occupation of defeated nations, and this new kind of ideological feud with the Soviet Union meant that the answer was to maintain conscription for fear of being caught out in the way that the British believed they were caught out in 1939. The historian David Edgerton actually really disputes the idea, and this kind of popular myth that the British have of themselves, that Britain was a poorly equipped, poorly prepared power in 1939. He says far from it. It was a very high technology power with a lot more money than Germany, and the failures really are those are the tactical failures on the battlefield, all the way up to about 1942, 1943, when Britain kind of at that point really begins to get its act together. So it's important not to go down this route too far, of which is kind of propagated by Churchill, who says, you know, I told everybody, I warned everybody, but no one listened to me. And, you know, well, Churchill is the kind of the writer of the history on this one, so you need to take that one with a pinch of salt. But it's also propagated by kind of popular culture an awful lot. There are innumerable kind of, again, films and plays and TV shows about Churchill and the Wilderness Years and the Gathering Storm and all this kind of stuff that suggests that Britain was completely unprepared. And, well, at the beaches of Dunkirk, the German army was quite amazed at the equipment that was left behind, you know, because of poor military decisions, and amazed sort of how well equipped that the British were, and highly envious. Anyway, the first uncertainty of post-war planning came from the fact that no one knew how soon the Soviet Union would be in a position to attack the West. It had been devastated by the Second World War, and early British planning was based on the belief that the Soviet Union was unlikely, that war with the Soviet Union was unlikely before 1957. The first long-term aim of post-war conscription was, therefore, to provide a large reserve of trained men of the kind that Britain had so conspicuously lacked at the beginning of the previous two world wars. In the First World War, the British had been able to shelter behind the French army during the 2 years that it had taken them to build up a large army of their own. In 1939 and 1940, the policy had failed, and the failure had almost proved disastrous. Now the aim was to lay the basis of a relatively quick mobilisation by requiring all young men to undertake a period of full-time service with the armed forces. They would then spend 6 years undergoing less intensive training as reservists. This would allow them to be recalled in a time of war. The policy gave little weight to commitments outside Europe and the Middle East. It rested on the assumption that the armed forces would have time to mobilise in the event of war, and on the expectation that they would have years in which to build up reserves. So, still an element of that kind of 1914-1939 thinking there, but also a series of assumptions based on the idea of Britain almost being some kind of siege nation during the Cold War. Countries that have permanent national service tend to be those who believe that they will be under attack from enemies at any given time. I suppose Israel is a classic modern example. Projections that Britain would have time to train and then recall huge numbers of reservists in the event of war came to seem optimistic. This was partly because the Soviet threat suddenly seemed much more imminent. Two events underline this. In March 1948, the Communist Party effectively took over Czechoslovakia. In June the same year, the Soviet Union blocked land access to West Berlin, forcing the Western powers to launch an airlift. And of course, the following year, you have the detection of the Soviets' first bomb. The Cold War also meant that the British kept troops in Austria and Trieste for longer than anticipated, and in 1948 began fighting against the communist forces in Malaya. So it's interesting that the British commitments in the Cold War in 1948 shape a particularly British worldview. US commitments really begin to shape America's sense of what the Cold War world would look like. The British pull out of Greece in 1947 as a result of the sterling crisis, not being able to afford the commitment there any longer. And Truman said that initiating the sterling crisis by allowing convertibility of the pound, which was a condition of the loan that Keynes had arranged in 1945, he said that was actually one of his biggest mistakes, because the America had precious little interest in becoming involved in Greece or propping up Greece, and convincing the American population to become involved in the problems of Greece and also Turkey was very, very difficult. The Truman Doctrine, his speech on the realities of the Cold War world, was in part due to the fact that the British could no longer afford to carry on this role. Other roles, of course, they did carry on, but Greece was the casualty of Britain's declining economic fortunes. And the role that Britain retreats from by 1947 has to start to be filled by the USA, which has implications for Britain's world power and has implications for America's world role. But we'll talk about that some more another time. Glad you've tuned in today. Hope you found this useful and interesting, and I'll catch you next time on the Explaining History podcast. Take good care, everybody. Thanks all a bunch, and all the best, and thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.